Our second case this morning is United States against Luke. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Lieutenant Michael Cerisi and I represent the appellant in this matter, Petty Officer Ivor Luke. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
In April of 2006, this court remanded appellant's case for two different inquiries to determine whether Philip Mills falsified pertinent results in appellant's tests or whether Philip Mills contaminated the results of appellant's tests. 4.5 years have passed, 2 Dubé hearings, an NCCA decision, and multiple USASIL investigations, and we still do not know the answer to this court's inquiry. Why do we not know? Because the United States government destroyed the physical evidence in appellant's case 3 months after it knew that it had a problem on its hands, that in December of 2003, Philip Mills had contaminated at least 5 cases at USASIL during the DNA forensic examination process.
What legal tests are we here to address and answer?
We're here to determine whether it's a new trial will probably produce a substantially better result for the appellant.
So the test is not did Mills or did Mills not contaminate something, right? But it's, you would focus this on the legal test, would you not?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, in this case, did the defense on appeal submit a petition for a new trial, or are we dealing with a defense challenge to the validity of the conviction?
It's a defense challenge to the validity of the conviction.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so the new trial standard is being applied by analogy rather than because there has been a request for a new trial in this case. Is that correct?
Right. Given the lack of testing that's available, given the structure of evidence, we are left with only what has been flushed out of the 2 Dubé hearings.
Why isn't Rodriguez controlling here with respect to the new trial?
Sorry, I missed the first
one. Why isn't Rodriguez controlling here? How do we have jurisdiction to entertain this?
Your Honor, this case was presented as an appeal under Article 67 originally to this court. This court remanded 4.5 years ago, and the trial process, the litigation process, has been relying upon that jurisdictional remand since that point.
In other words, basically what you're saying is equitably you ought to get it.
Well, I'm not sure if equitably is the word, Your Honor. It was remanded. It was on a direct appeal at that point. It didn't go through what Article 73 lays out as its petition for new trial process. It came directly to this court.
Are you saying 73 is not applicable?
The standard of 73 is applicable, but the test is for reliability of the conviction, as laid out by this court in Murphy, Your Honor.
The standard of 73 is applicable.
I'm sorry. The standard laid out in 73 and is elucidated by the RCMs probably produced a substantially better result. The standards are similar, but the procedural method of it getting to this point was different.
Is there any requirement in law that we apply the standard in Article 73?
No, Your Honor. There's
Thank
not.
You.
Counsel, I need a little clarification. I thought your answer to the chief judge was that you're not here on a petition for a new trial.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yet on page 27 of your brief, in the summary of your argument, your argument is that a new trial is required.
That would be the remedy requested, Your Honor. However, it's not the procedural method of getting to that point.
And why shouldn't you have to follow the regular procedure?
Your Honor, Article 73 doesn't preclude this type of action by the appellant 4.5 years ago by coming to this court.
Counsel, can you walk back just procedurally, just help me out here since I wasn't here for the case before? The trial occurred, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And appellant appealed to the CCA?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the appellant appealed the CCA's decision to this court?
Correct.
Within the time period under Article 67?
Yes, Your Honor.
And appellant alleged different violations and problems, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And said that what he wanted was a new trial?
Correct.
So why isn't this just a direct appeal, a direct appeal, and not an Article 73 issue at all?
If I've misspoken, it's certainly not an Article 73 issue. It is on direct appeal.
And Article 66 doesn't have a time period in it, does it?
No, Your Honor.
So does Rodriguez apply?
No, Your Honor. Well, what this court is...
I think that's what you had indicated, that this was all on remand from the direct appeal, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's right.
isn't the crux of the issue for you, on one hand, you have put adjective in here, a large amount of impeachment evidence, and on the other hand, you have to explain in some plausible manner how appellant's DNA got inside the bra. Is that correct? Is that the tension?
The explanation would be a contamination of some sort.
Blind. What?
The explanation would be a contamination of some sort, Your Honor, during the serology process.
Right, and what evidence, where did the military, the Dubai judges, or anybody else, for that matter, get something wrong in terms of contamination? You're saying you just can't prove it didn't occur, right?
There's no way for the appellant to be burdened with it, because it gives, given the destruction of physical evidence in this case, the appellant cannot prove that it did not occur. However, Your Honor, you mentioned the Dubai hearings, and I think that they should be seen in the light and the scope of the time period of when they occurred. The first was in 2006. After 2006, there was a substantial amount of investigation that occurred in this case. You still did their own investigation, I believe about six of them. An enormous amount of material was flushed out that occurred after that first Dubai hearing. The second Dubai hearing was more of a status report on this. The NCCA ordered that hearing to determine where the USACIL investigation was, and they're looking for, they're looking to kind of kick USACIL into finally complete
investigation. Can I just make sure the hinge is about the contamination of the bra, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, it can be certain things. I think that the contamination is one thing, and the painting of Philip Mills as an incompetent, deceitful, slothful analyst is another that could go towards, you know, we have indication that he was bad at finding stains on evidence. That could be used by the appellant at a new trial. We have indications that he contaminated DNA evidence in several cases. That could be used. We have
It goes ultimately towards undercutting whether Mills ended up with a bra that had been contaminated or not, correct?
Yes, sir.
That's the key piece, is it not?
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
And would it be whose responsibility would it ultimately be to assess that testimony? And that is it the responsibility of a Dubai judge? Is it the responsibility of the intermediate court? Or is it the responsibility of a panel, having been presented with all the evidence in the case?
I believe, Your Honor, it would be the entity that has the full picture, which would have been NMCCA, because at that point, NMCCA had the USACIL final report, which was not available at the second Dubai. It had the benefits of the first and second Dubais. It had the full picture at that point. And NMCCA had a burden of applying, Helen's view, a real-world perspective on this evidence and how real members would look at this evidence. And real members would frankly be horrified that Philip Mills conducted the forensic analysis and test. And they would be horrified to think that they may end up in the defense chair and have to face evidence created and analyzed by Philip Mills. And that is where the standards is applied. And that perspective would lead them to probably produce substantially better results for the appellant in a retrial.
Did the military judges, the Dubai judges, get something wrong other than the result, in your view? Is it the fact that in the absence of being able to demonstrate there was no contamination, they're just wrong in the result?
Well, for instance, Your Honor, the first Dubai hearing judge comes to very unequivocal conclusions that Philip Mills did not contaminate the evidence in this case. First off, that is an erroneous conclusion to come up with that unequivocal of a conclusion. And then to know that after that unequivocal conclusion, there have been 4.5 years of investigation that have flushed out the facts in this case, in which nobody looking at the entire package here 4.5 years later could come to the same conclusion as unequivocally as that first Dubai judge did.
Is it that no one could come to that conclusion, or is it that that's a determination that would be made by a court-martial panel? That would it be impossible for a court-martial panel to look at all this evidence and still return a conviction?
I'd say, Your Honor, I'd say nothing's impossible. But again, the state
would it be unlawful for them to do it? Would that be, in other words, looking at all the evidence, would it be unlawful for a court-martial to convict?
No, Your Honor. But the appellant's
position. So what's the standard then?
The standard is whether the new evidence would probably produce a substantially better result at trial.
So probable is what, 50% plus one?
I think that's a reasonable way of quantifying it, Your Honor.
Are you familiar with the Supreme Court's decision in a case called Messerosh against the United States, 352 U.S. 1, in which the court dealt with the integrity of a conviction based upon information developed after the trial about the activities of a government informant?
I'm not, Your Honor.
Okay. If that's a case in which the Supreme Court just said it was not a new trial standard that would be applied, but rather whether there was a taint that undermined the reliability of the conviction.
Yes, Your Honor. It's, I believe in this court's decision in Murphy, it borrows from the RCM 1210 standard, but the inherent analysis underneath the inquiry by this court and by the NMCCA is whether the results are reliable. Your Honor, I'd just like to point the court's attention, if I may, to several factual conclusions, erroneous conclusions that the NMCCA court made in their decision. For instance, they made a conclusion that the time period in which Philip Mills had protocol problems didn't extend back into the time period that we're talking about with appellant's case being analyzed. They said, I think, 2001 was the earliest date that they cite. However, their Dubé records flush out, the USISO final report flushes out, that he had been doing this since 2005.
Well, when you say had been doing this, what precisely do you mean by this?
I'd say just generally protocol problems, Your Honor. In 2008, when USISIL begins finding boxes of evidence squirreled around USISIL's laboratories and refrigerators and closets, they contain Philip Mills' work product. And in there, there's hundreds upon hundreds of samples that are mislabeled, miscategorized. These indicate protocol problems. These indicate that he's not following procedures. And that's the theme with Philip Mills, is that he has, and as Professor Shaler states, he has invented his own way of analyzing forensic evidence. And that comes right from the USISL's private analyst that's hired to look at this. And especially, Professor Shaler goes on, he doesn't say it's simply incompetence. He doesn't say it's simply laziness. He says Philip Mills knows the correct way of doing this, and he chooses not to do the correct way, to use the correct procedures, follow the correct protocols.
In serology or DNA, or we don't know?
They focus on DNA, Your Honor, but there are indications that his serology could be a problem as well.
Well, in this case, the DNA analysis was done by someone else, correct?
And that's
correct. Person testified at trial?
That's correct, Your Honor. However, the DNA analysis, of course, is reliant fully on what's presented to the DNA analyst. The serologist will be the person that takes the physical material, cuts out samples, and puts it in a test tube. And then the DNA analyst is the one that then stirs it up and does the DNA analysis on it. But if the serology is flawed, the DNA analysis will necessarily be flawed. It's the foundation upon which the DNA analysis and the statistical evidence entered against the appellant was based. It's all based upon this serology.
What are your three best arguments, facts, conclusions that you would point us to in the debate, hearings, and all that followed that would suggest a reasonable doubt or concern or fill in your own standard that something happened that contaminated the serology stage of the process?
It's hard to choose three, Your Honor. I guess I'd start with the fact that he is known to have contaminated during the DNA analysis. I would also look at their private outside expert who was called in to look at Philip Mills' work product. Professor Shaler said that he had invented a new way of doing forensic analysis. He was driven by numbers. He wanted to be the USISIL's number one most productive analyst, and he let things go. He skipped steps. He falsified things. He falsified notations on documents. Also, the opinions of his coworkers who did his quality assurance review, these are important. They knew about this, as I think it's Michael Ovdell testifies to. Every time someone would do a quality assurance review for Philip Mills, they'd have to go back to him and back to him and back to him because he had errors. He was a chronic error maker.
But despite all of that, the Dubé judge found that he was proficient in his serology
Your Honor, that's correct. The first Duvet judge in 2006 did say this. Again, the appellate at the point ask you to consider the fact that we've had 4.5 years of investigations since that first Duvet judge made that conclusion, rather unequivocal conclusion.
But we can't find additional facts at this point.
That's correct. But Your Honor, you can look at appellate statement. You can please look at the NMCCA opinion and determine whether they're making erroneous conclusions of law based upon Duvet records that are incomplete and focused on time periods that they don't really match up.
Well, they did look at the testing done in this case, didn't they?
Well, they tried to, Your Honor. They couldn't replicate the physical evidence test. There is no physical evidence. So, in fact, what NMCCA did is had to rely upon the paperwork generated by Philip Mills himself.
Not just the NMCCA, the Duvet hearing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Hearings,
that's,
judges.
That's correct. But again, because, Your Honor, the physical evidence is gone, we're left to rely upon the representations in a document by somebody who is a known document falsifier. It leaves us in a position where that's what we're left with, is relying upon the documents created by a person who we know falsified documents and falsified notations in his records. It's not really a position of strength for the government, Your Honor. When you look at the strength of the government's case, it's another factor to look at when we're determining whether the results of this court-martial are reliable. The victim in this case, there were three witnesses who came on and said that she had a character for untruthfulness, one of which just blurted out that she's a liar. Her boyfriend in this case, Fireman A, stated that he doesn't even trust her. So, and the members apparently didn't trust her. They acquitted the appellant of three of the five specifications that he was faced with. They convicted him of two. So seen in light of the totality of circumstances, certainly the reliability of this court-martial conviction is in question.
In paragraph 46 of the first Duvet judge's findings, the judge says, the sample of the bra was cut and sealed in a test tube before the other items were opened.
Your Honor,
why is that accurate or inaccurate?
Your Honor, the accuracy and accuracy goes, how is it? It's unequivocal. I guess that's the appellant's point. That first Duvet judge did not have 4.5 years investigation that flushed out Philip Mills's.
What about that specific question that you were asked, that Judge Baker asked?
I'm sorry,
What about the specific question that Judge Baker asked about the samples, other samples being sealed when he did that test?
The way that the judge made that finding is based upon Philip Mills's testimony. Given the 4.5 years investigation that have given, that judge would have given.
You keep on coming around to the same thing, which is because Mills was, fill in the blank, not a perfect lab person or a horrible lab person, you can fill in. Therefore, this is incorrect, so the judge got it wrong. But that's asking us to say because Mills made a mistake in some other case, this has to be an incorrect finding.
Your Honor, the finding, given what we know of Mills, should be he may or may not have correctly opened and followed.
So are you stating that there's no evidence upon which the judge could have relied that the sample of the bra was cut and sealed in a test tube before the other items were opened?
That evidence came directly from the mouth of Mills, who is known as a person who is known to misrepresent what he does in testing.
Was he known to lie under oath?
Clearly, appellant doesn't have any evidence of him lying under oath, Your Honor. But we know that he disguises his sloppiness in cutting of corners with notations.
Your problem is you're in a spider's web, and all the web lines lead back to Mills in the center of the web. I don't know if you want to adopt that wonderful metaphor, but that's the thing. It all comes back to Mills.
Your Honor,
no independent evidence that you need to rebut that the sample of the bra was cut and sealed in a test tube before the other items were opened.
Your Honor, that's it. Those words come from his mouth. The Duvet judge adopted them as a finding of fact. Before, The argument is that if he had known, the debate judge had known about the large scope of this investigation and what Mills, his true character was, that he wasn't a, necessarily a Scotland Yard-trained investigator.
Well, but the stuff that came later all undermines Mills as a lab person, but doesn't undermine, I mean, undermines indirectly, but not directly, this statement. Is that fair to say? There's nothing in the later stuff that says, to the contrary, the bedsheet was tested first.
Your Honor, there can be nothing. There is. It's all his testimony. That's all he relied upon, Your Honor. Your Honor, there's
I'm
no
just testing. I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I'm making sure I'm not missing anything.
That's correct. Again, it's all from his mouth.
Counsel, in terms of our role here, is our role here to determine what specifically happened in that situation, or to determine whether, in light of all the information the parties have brought to us on appeal, the determination by the military judge and the reliance of the NMCCA upon that is clearly erroneous or not?
It's not whether something happened, Your Honor, whether the reliance was clearly erroneous.
Thank you.
Counsel, just to clarify, during the first debate hearing, are you arguing that the debate hearing judge wasn't aware that he had falsified information and falsified reports? Because looking at some of the findings of fact, it looks like he was aware of that.
The scope of his falsifications and the scope of his work wasn't completely known to the first debate judge, Your Honor. And I'd argue that it wasn't even known until the issuance of the USASIL final report in 2008.
So you're talking about scope, not the fact that he was aware that he had falsified information.
The breadth of the information developed after that debate was substantially significant, Your Honor, and really enlightened, would have enlightened the judge had he known.
Thank you, counsel. You have a further opportunity on rebuttal. We'll give the government an additional 4 minutes here. We're not encouraging you to take it, but you'll have that.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Efrata, may it please the court.
What is paragraph 46 based on other than Mills' testimony?
I'm sorry, paragraph 46, Your
Honor? Of the, any paragraph. Paragraph 46, you cite to it in your brief, which is why you're familiar, I've been confident saying it like that. Paragraph 46 of the first Dubay judge's findings. He concludes that the sample of the bra was cut and sealed in a test tube before the other items were opened. What is that based on?
Well, I think it's all the testimony that during serology procedures, you examine one piece of evidence at a time. And I think that the testimony of not just Mr. Mills, but the other serology examiners.
Can you cite the specific pages that support that finding, which is a critical finding and which you rely on in your brief?
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor. I'm more than happy to provide that at a later time.
Are you prepared to say that it's based on something other than Mr. Mills' own testimony?
No, I think it's also based on the testimony of the other examiners that talk about the serology procedures.
Did the other examiners state that the bra was cut up and sealed before the sheet was looked at?
No, I think that's a reasonable conclusion from Mr. Mills' testimony, Your Honor.
So it is all derivative of Mr. Mills?
With regard to this specific case, yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. I just was wanting to follow up while it was fresh in my mind. I didn't mean to completely destroy the flow of your presentation.
The lower court's application of the correct legal principles to the particular facts of this case was not clearly unreasonable, and the verdict is reliable for three primary reasons. First, Mr. Mills merely performed the serology analysis in this case. And while the potential
but you would agree that if he put the wrong stuff in the wrong tube, that the DNA tester gets the DNA they get?
Well, I think, Your Honor, he'd had to have taken one of the control samples and put that into contact with the bra or the bedsheet. It's not, the examiners other than Mr. Mills talk about the potential for contaminations in serology. And it's not like it is in DNA, where simply coming into contact very briefly or simply, you know, doing these five tests at a time, you can have cross-contamination amongst all the tests. First of all, if you follow the protocol, you're only examining one piece of evidence at a time when you're doing serology. So in this case, he would have only had the bra out and only been looking for stains with that bra. And then he takes that bra, cuts out the stain, and puts it in the test tube. Now, the only real potential for cross-contamination are both of the appellant's control samples, one of which was his saliva and one of which was his blood. Now, the saliva, according to Mr. Mills' notes, was not even examined. And certainly, Mr. Mills has his problems, but one of his problems asserted by the appellant was that he was lazy and he didn't follow all the procedures. Well, it's reasonable to believe, however, that if he says he didn't examine something, he probably didn't actually examine it. So it's not reasonable to believe that a sample, which Mr. Mills didn't even examine, he merely perhaps took out of the box, put right back in the box, it's not reasonable to believe that that somehow contaminated the broth. The other potential would be appellant's blood sample. But Ms. Chase, the DNA examiner, testified during the debate hearing that if a blood sample were to contaminate a piece of evidence, you'd be able to see a brown or reddish stain. So the asserted basis for the cross-contamination in this case doesn't...
Okay, really, why not the sheet?
Just the same, Ryder. The same analysis would be the same. The two control samples would not have come into contact with the sheet.
Yeah, but why couldn't the sheet contaminate the bra?
Well, again, Ryder, because they're not being examined at the same time.
So it could, if the protocol wasn't followed. It's not that there's something about sheets.
Right, and certainly the examiners talk about how if Mr. Mills had some kind of desire to, if he wanted to purposely contaminate the evidence, you could take the bra that maybe contained the DNA and rub it up against the sheet. But that's why it's critical to understand the allegations against Mr. Mills are not that of intentional malfeasance along the lines of the trooper Zane in the West Virginia case. And because they're simply that he was perhaps slothful or deceitful in the test, it's not the type of case where we need to throw out anything that Mr. Mills ever touched or came into contact with. If I may briefly turn to the appellant's asserted motive to fabricate on the part of the victim in this case. Now, the argument does not make logical sense here because the charges were not actually collateral to the victim's misconduct. This is not the garden variety, perhaps, 120 case involving the use of alcohol involved in the charged acts. This is a victim who engaged in a month-long course of conduct and living with her boyfriend in violation of a ship's order, a dating relationship that she testified went on for 15 months. It's not reasonable for her to believe that somehow reporting of a sexual assault is going to absolve her of this conduct that occurred over a month-long period. In other words, the motive to fabricate, that it does not actually logically meet up with the charged acts in this case.
Well, I'm not sure I follow that. If an individual is facing possible exposure, why don't they have a motive then to change the nature of the environment in which everything is going to be considered?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, that
change the nature of the environment from a benign, although improper, relationship to one of an aggressive and improper sexual attack.
Well, I think that if you're referring to the victim's actions with the appellant, I'm not sure I follow the question, Your Honor.
My question is, when we're talking about whether someone has a motive to fabricate, if in this case, was there testimony that the nature of the relationship was going to be exposed?
That was appellant's testimony, certainly, sir.
So there was testimony in the record as to that effect?
Yes, sir.
And in that environment, why wouldn't somebody who's facing that exposure have a motive, perhaps not well thought out, but nonetheless a motive, to change the whole environment so that instead of that person being solely under investigation for a benign relationship, although in violation of regulations, the investigation would instead focus primarily on a person who engaged in an aggressive assault?
Well, I think it's certainly reasonable to think that at first perhaps they would focus on this assault, but again, when you're talking about a course of conduct that goes for 15 months, and this was something that she lived with her boyfriend. It's not as if there's no direct connection between her living with her boyfriend and the charged acts in this case. Now, certainly those facts are going to come out, but it's not as if you're engaging in sexual activity in a barracks in contravention of an order or drinking that is going to come out directly as you report the assault. I think that, while certainly there perhaps could be a scintilla of a motive to fabricate, it's not as if appellant, I think, takes the position that this motive to fabricate destroys her credibility, and the government simply asserting that this is not, although we often hear that argument made in these cases, the logical connection in this case does not match up.
I thought the appellant's argument was that if we had this evidence, that it would tend to potentially impeach the serologist, which in turn would have a spillover effect of potentially impeaching the victim.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that's the primary focus. But in order to succeed, I believe the appellant must demonstrate that absent the discredited DNA or serology evidence, that the result is not nonetheless reliable.
What's the government's position on the position of Article 73 in the context of this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the asserted grounds for his first assignment of error is that new discovered evidence warrants a new trial.
But you don't dispute that a new trial was not sought from the Judge Advocate General?
Correct, Your Honor, absolutely.
So is this an Article 73 case, or are they able to avoid it being an Article 73 case by asking for the same thing and not following the procedure in Article 73? I mean, what is a function of Article 73 in the context of this case?
Well, I think that Article 73 governs simply because that's the substantive thrust of the petition. I mean, even if we perhaps call this by another name, the fact of the matter is that appellant from get-go has cited the standards in RCM 1210 and Article 73 for warranting a new trial. And certainly that's the procedure that the UCMJ has set forth for newly discovered evidence post-trial. So although we might call it something else, I think all parties are under the impression that that's the governing standard, and that's really what we're trying to get at here, is whether that standard is met.
Judge Ryan, did you have further follow-up on that? Did the defense necessarily request that because they want a new trial, or do they request it because under Murphy that's the standard for attacking the reliability of a verdict?
Well, I think that it is both, Your Honor. I think that, well, first we would hope to distinguish Murphy based on it being a death case. Now, certainly the standard, the reliability of result, has been applied for Article 73 cases following that, but I think that the thrust of their claim from the beginning has always been that this is your standard RCM 1210 case. You have evidence that they could not have discovered with due diligence. It came up after trial, and they would like a new trial on that basis. So I think it's a little bit of both.
Would you address the appellant's construction of 73?
With regard to this?
Yeah. Do we have jurisdiction or don't we over that issue?
Well,
and if so, why?
Well, Your Honor, we don't believe you. An Article 73 petition, of course, you would not have jurisdiction over based on the two-year time limit.
Based on Rodriguez.
But Article 73 a jurisdictional statute, or is it defining it? And what does it have to do with the jurisdiction of a CCA or the jurisdiction of this court? Isn't it rather a time limitation as to when an appellant is entitled to do something? It doesn't say anything about jurisdiction at all.
Well no, Your Honor, but I think it's simply relying on Bowles for the proposition that a time limit inside of the statute is jurisdictional. As far as certainly with an Article 73 type case, and getting to the finality arguments, it's the type of thing that without a time limit based on 73, obviously the open-ended nature of newly discovered evidence could last forever.
Does the fact that we took jurisdiction of this thing pre-Rodriguez make any difference?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. With regard to an Article 73 petition.
That's with regard to Issue 1.
Correct.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor, we agree with what.
If the appellant says, I don't want a new trial, I've got a conviction that's unreliable based upon the evidence that's been developed as to government misconduct in my case, why isn't that governed by the Supreme Court's decision in Mesirage, 352 U.S. 1, at least in terms of jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are other avenues for appellant to pursue that type of remedy. Such as the writ. I mean, if it's a fraud on the court martial, then of course that would be an error of a fundamental character. So it's not as we believe it. This is not a case with a right without a remedy.
So you recommend that the appellant go away and come back next week with a quorum nobis petition, and justice is best served by that?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that's what the precedent of this court commands. Whether or not it's the best course of action, of course, I can't speak to that. But I think that's what Rodriguez commands with regard to a petition for a new trial.
Is it fair to say you agree with the second Dubé judge's findings and conclusions?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that would include the conclusion that there was no sense of urgency on the part of the lab administration or their chain of command to resolve the weighty issues associated with the substantial allegations pending against them?
Well,
agree with that. The government agrees that there is no sense of urgency.
Well, certainly the investigation wasn't a model of dispatch. Whether we agree with that, perhaps not, but is that
really the government be outraged if it takes that long, regardless of this case? But you've got a lot of cases, and you've got a lab guy who's mucked up a lot of cases in some way, at least created appellate issues. You're satisfied with the level of, you agree with the judge, or don't you?
Well, we don't agree with him in the sense that the delay was unreasonable. I think that when you look at the mountain that USASIL had to overcome in this case, not just in this case, but in every case, I mean, it's certainly reasonable.
So no sense of urgency was reasonable?
Well, again, we would take issue with the no sense of urgency portion of that of that finding of fact, Your Honor. I think when you look at the entire record of this case, the delay was reasonable for the reasons asserted. I mean, this was not simple. This had to be a thorough undertaking. It could not simply be, you know, a basic investigation. It required outside contractors. It required multiple cases.
Does the record reflect that the government did anything, the government being the appellate shops, did anything to move this along? Does the record reflect that or not?
Certainly, both sides requested enlargements at most levels before they filed their brief, Your Honor. I don't know if that's the
27 total.
No, but I meant in terms of moving the USCAL administration and their chain of command forward in terms of resolving these substantial and weighty issues.
No, I don't know.
The record does not reflect whether the government, as in the appellate shops, or the government did anything to ensure that happened in a timely manner.
I believe
in the interest of justice.
I believe the second CCA opinion references the government's efforts, Your Honor, but I don't have any facts, any direct facts, Your Honor. Turning back to the scientific evidence in this case, the government believes it's crucial to actually look at, during the first and second debate hearing, the testimony of the examiners about what the serology process is. And again, their specific and direct testimony that contamination is much more likely to occur during DNA analysis. And when appellant references the five cases that were contaminated, and this is what originally revealed Mr. Mills' misconduct or problems, that was only one test. That was five cases that were being tested at one time. And again, when you actually look at serology, which is the examination of one piece of evidence at a time, the fact that he was not able to test five cases at a time does not necessarily mean he was not able to examine one item of evidence. Turning briefly to the cases cited by appellant, 120 cases where a new trial was warranted, the government believes they are, of course, distinguishable based on the fact that in those cases, and this is Niles, Williams, and Stoska, or I'm sorry, Niles, Williams, and Singleton, it was the testimony of one witness that formed the entire piece of the government's case. Whereas in this case, you not only had the victim and the scientific evidence, you actually had the boyfriend's testimony, which corroborated it. You had Fireman McNiff, who testified that Ardiente, the boyfriend, approached him, asked him for a ride home, and was crying, which would, of course, corroborate the fact that he was just told that his girlfriend was sexually assaulted. You also had the senior chief, who testified that, despite appellant's story, that he wanted to report this illicit sexual relationship the second he could. When the senior chief actually talked to appellant about the case, appellant made no mention of this illicit relationship, again, undercutting his trial testimony and his NCIS statement about his reasons for conducting the examination into Fireman Ardiente and actually talking to the victim on the night in question. If there are no further questions, thank you. This concludes the government's argument. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Just briefly, Your Honor, the government says that he talks about how contamination is unlikely if you follow the protocol. And that really is the key point. If you follow the protocol, contamination is unlikely. If you follow the protocol, the everything will be bagged appropriately, and nothing will contaminate each other. But we know from Professor Schiller's analysis that Philip Mills invented his own way of doing forensic analysis. He didn't follow the protocol. He knew what he needed to do, and he specifically avoided it in order to become the most successful and efficient and prolific USASIL analyst in the shop.
Now, was Ms. Chase according to the debate record, was she aware or not aware of Mr. Mills' problems at the time?
She was aware.
She was?
Yes.
So why isn't it significant then that she said that if she was aware at the original trial and she was asked about contamination, why shouldn't we read her testimony on that with particular care?
Ms. Chase also...
That's a hard question, but please respond to that.
I understand, Your Honor. Ms. Chase also goes on to describe what it takes to discover a contamination in serology. It's exceedingly difficult, and she and the appellant has cited this, some excerpts from her testimony. A DNA analyst isn't going to find contamination in the serology portion of the test unless there's some kind of mold growing in a test tube. Like incredibly blatant, obvious things will throw off the alarm bells for a DNA analyst. But Marilyn Chase says that. She said she didn't find any contamination, but that's not because it's not to be found. You can't find contamination unless it's like something incredibly obvious.
How would this contamination have occurred in this case? What are the possibilities?
Your Honor, in the debate, I believe it's the first debate hearing, I believe it's Michael Obdell testifies about the ways a contamination can occur. It's as simple as sometimes leaving two bags of evidence open at the same time. Given how the nature of DNA evidence in skin cells kind of sloughing off of a person, like they're ubiquitous. If you leave two bags of evidence open at the same time, that can cause contamination. Not changing your gloves between handling different pieces of evidence can cause a cross-contamination. Using the same tong that hasn't been disinfected between.
So he would have had to have opened the control samples, though, initially.
Your Honor,
where else could it have come from?
Well, they can come from the two different things. There's a sheet from the medical spaces, which is probably covered with Petty Officer Luke's DNA because he works there. Then you have a DNA that's covered with the victim's DNA. Abroad is covered with the victim's DNA. You don't need to get into these control samples. The government states, if you follow protocol, the only way in which you can contaminate would be through the use of a control sample and that you'd find blood on it. Well, that's the whole point, is that Philip Mills didn't follow protocol. He wasn't someone that did that. We shouldn't rely upon that, Your Honor.
But the Chase does say that she didn't see any indication of low-level background contamination, which would eliminate at least some of those possibilities, the two bags left open possibility.
Well, given the nature of DNA, I think it's flushed out in the appellant's brief, has some specific sites to it, that it's just incredibly difficult to find contamination when you're doing the DNA analysis process that occurred from the serology, just because of the nature of DNA, just a little cell that ends up on a stain, and then that's it.
Did either Dubay judge make findings of fact with respect to elimination of potential contamination sites or sources?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. But
thank you.
If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel.
You've already addressed it, but isn't that what the first Dubay judge does in paragraph 46? Now, you've had a chance to say why it's not reliable in your view, but I'm confused now.
I believe, and I'd have to reread that, Your Honor. I believe that the first Dubay judge is saying that the procedures were followed, but not that. I'm not sure if he rules out contamination altogether, but I'd have to read it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. The court will be in recess. Thank you very much.
All rise.